Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday afternoon. On May 17th, 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate education facilities are inherently unequal. In a new report that will be issued by schools and communities this coming Saturday, the 60th anniversary of that decision, we find incredible statistics. You'll recall, perhaps you won't, you weren't alive during these years, but in 1976, a federal court ordered desegregation of Milwaukee's public schools. But this year, almost three-quarters of African-American students attend elementary schools that are 90% or more non-white. 43% of Hispanic students attend the same kind of school, and more than a quarter of white students attend schools that are 90% or more white. Schools and communities are committing themselves to revitalizing civil rights movement, recognizing what they describe as the inherent links between strong public schools, healthy communities, and a multiracial democracy. We have two guests with us here in our Milwaukee studios. James Hall. James is president of the Milwaukee chapter of the NAACP. James, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. And Bob Peterson, president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association. And the keynote speaker will be Donna Brazil. Bob, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You know, I look at those statistics, and they just are incredible. We must have had a similar situation back in 1954 in this community. What have, you know, it's just as segregated almost, isn't it, James?
Yes. The striking thing about it is that, as you indicate, prior to 1954, of course, the nation was operating under the legal theory, the legal case of Plessy versus Ferguson, which had been decided in 1896, and which, you know, that wasn't so long after slavery. In 1896, the court decided Plessy versus Ferguson, which codified separate but equal as the law of the land. Of course, separate is unequal, as Brown found, but separate but equal was the law of the land. And in the South, there was thorough and complete separation of the races by law. In the North, such as Milwaukee, it was by practice, you know. But throughout the nation, there was complete and thorough separation of the races, meaning in education, in housing, in employment, in voting. You know, many states passed voting laws to limit or prohibit African Americans from voting. So just across the board, you had, you know, absolute separation. And these laws were known as Jim Crow laws. That whole period was known as Jim Crow. And these laws were designed to keep African Americans in an inferior position. And ultimately, after a whole century of legal strategy and bringing cases and, you know, step by step attacking these laws, ultimately the Supreme Court in 1954 decided the Brown case, which significantly overturned Plessy versus Ferguson and the concept of separate but equal, finding, as you indicated, separate is inherently unequal, and overturned Jim Crow and ushered in, supposedly, an era of equality. Not only equality in education, but as we know, that then expanded to many other areas of life, meaning in, there were shortly thereafter other Supreme Court cases and the civil rights movement in the 60s resulting in the Voting Rights Act and the Federal Fair Housing Act and, you know, equality in terms of immigration rights, disability rights, housing, you know, and across the board. So Brown overturned the notion of separate but equal and the notion of Jim Crow, mm-hmm. and was supposed to usher in an era of equality, which leads us to where we are today in Milwaukee. Unfortunately, we are number one in the nation in most, in fact, of the indicators of inequality, like pre-Brown, we are number one in, you know, and we could talk about all of those areas.
How would you describe what we have now, Bob Pearson?
Well, I think it's Milwaukee is on the verge of becoming a poster child for the new Jim Crow in this country. And I think we have to change the narrative and change our direction so that we become a poster child for a multiracial democracy. I mean, what James said is true. Milwaukee is number one, the worst in the nation of 102 largest metropolitan areas in black and white residential segregation. We're worst in the nation in residential segregation based on poverty. And obviously, when you look at housing segregation, it has a direct impact on our schools. Mm-hmm. And so it really flows. That's why we can't separate this issue, schools, housing, jobs. Similarly, though, it's not just in residential segregation. Wisconsin, Milwaukee is number one in the black-white employment gap in terms of 32.4 percent points and 20.6% for women percentage, the widest racial gap in employment. And I know as a teacher that when my 10-year-old and 11-year-old fifth grade students are, you know, part of their issue or problem is the fact that their parents aren't making livable wages or their parents are working at a job that doesn't provide sick days. And so my 10-year-old student might be gone taking care of the 2-year-old sibling because the mother would be fired. If she stayed home with the 2-year-old, who suffers? The 10-year-old kid who doesn't get to go to school. So all these issues are directly connected. You know, there was a recent report put out by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which said that Wisconsin is the worst state in the country in protecting the well-being of African-American children based on 12 key indicators. And we all know, you've had people on the show, I think, around the Wisconsin having the worst incarceration rate for black men. You put these all together, and then you add to it attempts in the state legislature to what I would call suppress voting rights, and you have a pretty scary picture of a trend in our society towards greater divisions, greater inequality, greater segregation based both on race and economics. We're calling on May 17th for our community to look at this seriously, not only commemorate the Brown decision, but it's a call to action. It's a kickoff for a campaign that we want to start, which talks about the kind of schools and communities all our children deserve.
Mm-hmm. It's such a huge issue. I've been in this community long enough to just about remember when the desegregation order came down. And what happened was you had certain kinds of schools, and you're trying to attract white suburban kids to those schools. So you had, you know, art schools, and you had IB schools, and to make it attractive for white kids to come into the city. And then you had movements that would take African American kids to Southside schools, and not as many Southside students coming to the Northside, to where there were African American populations. But you did have this whole thing in place. Was that a good remedy? Was that in the spirit of Brown versus the Board of Education? And are there any remnants of that exist now? And should they exist now, James?
Well, I think at the time, you know, when Brown was decided, 1954, the first decision was on liability, and it found, as we just said, that these separate schools were unequal and made them unlawful. Then the next phase, the court then rendered another decision, Brown 2, which was on remedy, and the court ordered that school districts should desegregate. It said with all deliberate speed, but that ended up meaning foot dragging.
Took a while, right.
Yeah. So there were cases into the late 60s and into the 70s, as we found here in Milwaukee, that were kind of the next phase of those desegregation cases. And as in Milwaukee, many of the remedies ended up with busing orders. Desegregation orders, which included busing. Now, we know when you have a metropolitan area that's as segregated as Milwaukee's, the real remedy for school separation and segregation is housing. I mean, to have people living in integrated neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But when you have the degree of segregation we have, and had then, still have now, then busing becomes the viable remedy to do that. So I would say, yes, it was the busing remedy was in the spirit of carrying out the desegregation order and finding of Judge Reynolds. Now, I think most people, I don't know anyone who was completely happy with the busing, meaning, as you indicated, much of the busing, not only in Milwaukee, but throughout the country, black families felt it was on the burden of students moving out to the suburbs. As you said, there were in this case, to other parts of the city, there were magnet schools to try to attract white students to into the inner city and so forth. What also started happening, though, was more white families started leaving the city. The system started becoming more and more predominantly black and brown, which, notwithstanding all that could be done in the intra-district scenario, meaning trying to integrate Milwaukee, the whole MPS system was becoming more and more, black and brown, as more whites moved to the suburbs and so forth, which led, you may recall, to the second round of cases here, the inter-district case that where MPS sued the suburbs mm-hmm. in the state, resulting in an expansion of 220. Mm-hmm. Now, the 220 program was then designed to try to enhance inter-district integrative mm-hmm. education. So all of this was in the spirit of trying to achieve and maintain some degree of racial integration. Mm-hmm. We haven't done a good job, you know, here in Milwaukee, as in other parts of the country, but even the 220 program was and is a good program that the numbers indicate that it improves performance. But there's not much support for that program right now.
Sure,
in fact, open enrollment
right.
undermines that and opens slots for more white kids to be able to transfer to the suburb.
Right.
Yeah. It shows how we are going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I just would add that at the time of the DSEG suit, Judge Reynolds suit, I was actually involved in a group called the People United for Quality Education and Integration. And it should be noted two things. One is the school board appealed that suit, all the way to the Supreme Court, spent $1 million. So there was all this questions about whether or not it actually would become law. Secondly, the mayor at that time never came out in favor of it. And even the superintendent just said, well, we'll just have to follow the Constitution. He didn't say it was a good thing. So very little training was done. Plus, there was a whole community effort to try to pair and cluster black and white schools together and get the neighborhood so there'd be a limited busing, you know, from one neighborhood to another. And there was actually white people on the south side and black people on the north side who worked together to do that. But that was rejected. And instead, it was just a matter of that James described, heavy emphasis on sort of a shotgun approach to busing, some specialty schools. And I would say that there are pockets of great integrated schools in Milwaukee. And one of the benefits of sending your child to the Milwaukee Public Schools is they get a diverse, in many schools, get a very diverse experience.
It's a huge benefit.
You know, it's of all the dozens of language groups. There's black, Latino, Asian, Native American. I know my two children went to the Milwaukee Public Schools into different integrate. Usually they were in the minority, but they benefited so greatly in terms of who they their friends were and their ability to navigate and learn and respect people of different races. That's one of the unknown gems of the Milwaukee Public Schools.
Yeah. The other thing, of course, that's happened is that the whole school system has changed so radically, and I'm wondering what role vouchers, and we now have 25,000 young people from who used to be a part of MPS who are now part of the voucher program, as the system became more segregated, probably poorer, there was an attack on, I think, Milwaukee Public Schools. Well, the schools are terrible, and we got to do something very different, and let's try what was thought to be an experiment a long time ago in this right. country, which actually doesn't seem to be working out all that well if you're going to base things on test scores. But I'm wondering, the whole movement to do voucher schools that are primarily religious, the effect that this has had on integration in the community in which we are now sitting.
You want to start?
Yeah. I know one thing that's very clear, what you said, is the vouchers siphon tax dollars out of our public schools. You know, they over $1.3 billion in tax dollars have been taken from the public school funds to voucher schools since the beginning of the program. As you said, it's a failed experiment. It originally was going to really not only improve the voucher schools but push the public schools. Now they just say it's a cheaper experiment. They really skirt basic accountability. I mean, I think we have to understand that public schools are the only institution in this community to have the commitment, capacity, and legal obligation to serve all students. And that's the institution that's the foundation of democracy. We bring all people together. We have a lot to improve in the public schools, granted, but instead of abandoning the public schools, we need to improve them. Unfortunately, a lot of the power brokers in the city have abandoned them, and that's not a way to support a democratic society. We also know that the more difficult to educate children, some of the children with special needs, kids with behavioral problems, children with who are learning English as a second language, there's a much higher concentration of those students in the public schools than in voucher schools or even in the city charter schools.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, James.
May I just add?
Sure.
Relating it back to Brown, the Supreme Court in the Brown decision found that or stated that providing a public education is one of the, if not the most important function of government. I mean, that's a very important function. And as Bob just indicated, when we have a voucher system, that system, you know, contemplates that there will be a select number of seats for a few students, you know, a number of students who go to the voucher schools. Well, first of all, the studies indicate performance is no better, so people are being sold a big bill of goods on that. But secondly, to the extent that there are still 80,000 students or so left in the public school system, resources are drained from them, and those students are generally the poorest, the hardest to educate, you know, students who are left there without then advocates for them, because the community, the voucher program is such a distraction that whereas in other communities, powerful and serious advocates are advocating for the whole school system, all of those people are behind vouchers, leaving, you know, fewer advocates for the whole public school system. It's discriminatory. It doesn't take into account students with learning disabilities, so it leaves those students to the public school system. As Bob said, there's not accountability, and people can be kicked out of school and so forth without without having due process rights, and a lot of parents don't realize that in the first instance. Send their kids to voucher schools, then they call and say, hey, my child was kicked out, with no due process, because there's little or no accountability. The voucher schools are much more segregated than the Milwaukee public schools, meaning that, as Bob said about diversity, there are many one-race schools in the voucher program. So it's, as a general proposition, the education is more diverse and segregated in public schools than in voucher schools. If the answer to the voucher answer was so good, then why is it that most communities, say New York City and many other cities around the country, rejected vouchers because they see the value of a broad-based public education? And why is it that we have vouchers and have the worst results in the country? And it's finally, I would say, it's hypocritical that many of the people who are so outraged, you know, about the performance of MPS and how it bad MPS does, meaning the supporters of vouchers, are not as outraged or not really don't seem to be outraged at all about many of those other data that we talked about the unemployment and the poverty and the incarceration and all of those things that are the front end factors that feed into the, you know, education results. I think it's a scapegoat to beat up on the public school system and not be as outraged about those other factors.
So, Bob, considering the fact that all of this found its way through the courts and through subsequent courts, 60 years ago on Saturday, separate but equal has no place. Separate education facilities are inherently unequal. As you look at what's a huge issue, because you're weaving in poverty and you know, racism and incarceration rates and voting and politics, I mean, you're taking on this huge thing. Is there a way for this to go through the courts again, as it did 70 years ago, to determine that indeed schools are once again separate and not equal, and that the court needs to come up with a 2014 remedy? Is anybody doing that or not?
I don't think so, but James, if you know, you can let me know. I mean, I have some opinions about how to handle that, but go ahead, James, if you want to.
No, that's a very good point and an interesting point you make. There have been cases recently on – there have been school financing cases.
Yes.
You know, cases
right.
That
right.
that address the issue of whether or not there's fairness and equity in terms of the dollars behind each student and that type of thing. Insofar as these remedies, it's you know, what you mentioned there is very interesting, but I'm not sure that cases have developed in that vein because metropolitan areas have changed, and you know, Milwaukee obviously isn't the only city where the system has become predominantly, you know, has become, you know, the demographics have changed drastically.
Mm-hmm.
And so the courts have found it hard to maintain the same types of remedies as before. However, in Milwaukee, as we just said, because of the voucher program and open enrollment and so forth, our public school system is undermined more than most and puts us in a more difficult situation.
Yeah.
So what we have to do then is not looking for legal remedies, but look for political remedies and to change the conversation. We really have to change the narrative and discussion in our community so that we see the severity and the impact of the growing racial and economic segregation and inequalities in our city, and have a conversation about how are we going to dismantle segregation and to put that on the table. This city has an aversion. Let's see, some of the power brokers at least, to talk about the hard issues of race, segregation, and economic inequality. And we have to do that because we'll be doomed to live an American version of apartheid if we don't confront this. And I know it's oftentimes people say, well, it is what it is. You know, the metropolitan area is very segregated. Well, that's true. There used to be slavery. Women didn't used to have the right to vote. There was child labor. Huge problems in our society. We address those through a combination of conversation, political movements, initiatives, legal. You know, we have to do it all. And we're saying right now, and May 17th is a kickoff to do that. And we encourage people to come. We're going to have a unity parade starting at 10 o'clock from the Martin Luther King Center on 14th and Valete down to the Milwaukee High School of the Arts. Then we're going to have a program from 11 to 12:30 with the keynote speaker is Donna Brazil, a nationally known commentator and very dynamic speaker. But we're going to have elementary students, high school students, community people talking and about what we plan on doing. And finally, afterwards, we're gonna, if anybody wants a free lunch and a conversation, a conversation about how we can organize more in the community. So it's an activity that is open to children, parents, everybody. And it's more information is at the schoolsandcommunitiesunited.org website.
We welcome phone calls and we'll take them. Bob just framed what the issue I would like to hear you address is. How do we dismantle segregation? It's a fairly large question. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Bob Peterson, president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, James Hall, president of the Milwaukee chapter of the NAACP, are with us, and we're talking about the event May 17th, marking the 60th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, a unanimous decision that outlawed school segregation. And we're looking at where Milwaukee is. Our guests would say that this area and much of the country, but this area really is witnessing a new Jim Crow. So what do you think? To you and your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls, starting with Lori in St. Francis. Hi, Lori.
Yes, hi. I am 81 years old, and I was a member of that community forum that your speaker spoke about earlier, the Committee of 100, where we discussed matters of race in the city after the judgment came down that we needed to take care of that situation. Two of my children, my youngest, went to Garfield Avenue School, which was at the time beginning as an open ed place. Yep. And my experience was both terrifying and wonderful. Terrifying because I was experiencing on a bad winter night my children being bused from the school on the north side, getting home at 6:30 and 7 at night, as many, many black parents have experienced in their lifetimes. And wonderful because we did meet some parents' organization, met in homes around the school area, black parents and white parents on the black side of the neighborhood and on the south side of the neighborhood. It was one of the most moving and learning experiences of my life. And my children, by the way, did very well after that.
So what do you think we should do now, Lori?
I wish I knew. At the time that we went to the bus thing, we all knew it was a neighborhood thing. It was having people move into your neighborhood where we could talk with each other and greet each other. But we just couldn't manage it at the time. And I think that is the answer. But how we get there, I have no idea.
Okay, it's all right, Lori. Thought I would ask. Thank you very much for the call. How do we dismantle segregation, James?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a matter of attitudes. And even before just saying the word attitude, I think we have to have a willingness to look in the mirror, to look ourselves, you know, to look at ourselves. And this commemoration of Brown is the perfect time to do it, as we discuss what it meant and what it represented, to look at ourselves as a community and say, is this what we want to be? Do we really want to be, out of the whole United States? Let's think about that for a moment. Of the nation, do we want to be the place with the highest degree of segregation and these negative data that we are talking about? Like in incarceration, do we want to be the state with the highest level of incarceration of African-American males in the, not only in the nation, but it's been reported in the world, that from zip code 53206, there may be the highest rate of incarceration in the world? Is that what we want to be? So we have to kind of take our head out of the sand, look at ourselves, and then, you know, change the attitudes and then develop policies and so forth that are forward-looking and progressive. I'll give two examples. One is Bob Hankin of Public Policy Forum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he was on a panel the other day, and I was listening to him talking about transportation, how in every other major metropolitan area in the nation, their transportation initiatives are being put forth to expand transportation opportunities and to, you know, move diverse populations and make things more accessible. Here, it's just the opposite. We are limiting and you know, making things less accessible as it relates to inclusiveness and jobs and opportunities and so forth. Another, New York Times had has had several articles recently about the whole inequality issue in various metropolitan areas and how other cities are taking specific measures to fight, to address inequality, to tackle it. New York City, we know with the new mayor and, you know, is implementing a lot of things. Seattle and other cities, specifically, you know, in terms of an attitude to address these things. We as a community, I think, need to, first of all, you know, confront ourselves in the mirror and then, you know, deal with the attitude toward these issues and then develop policies to address them.
Yeah, I agree with James. Obviously, we need a regional transportation system, not just a county one. We should have low and moderate income housing throughout the four-county metropolitan area. And I'll just say that Schools and Communities United, along with some other organizations in the city, will be launching this summer a contest for people to come up with ideas about how to dismantle segregation. And we'll, and when I say contest, cheapens what I'm really saying. We're asking for serious proposals. We'll have a public forum that would vet these proposals, and we want people to start discussing how can we desegregate, you know, this metropolitan region, and you know, not only race but economic terms. And what are some proposals? I mean, why aren't there summer schools, say, between Sherwood and Whitefish Bay and MPS? You know, that would be one little step that would bring people together. Maybe then it would lead to metropolitan schools, you know, setups or something. I mean, I'm not putting forth any one particular thing, but these kind of institutions were created by human beings. They didn't come down from the sky, and it's going to be up to us to dismantle them in a way so that we can all unify together and have a much more a safer and healthier community environment, not only in the city but throughout.
Thank you, Lori, very much for your call. Let's go to Patrick in Janesville. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. How are you doing today?
All right, Patrick. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I had a comment, I guess, regarding the economic, which I truly believe is the driving force of you know, the problem with prisons, the problems with education. You know, people have a decent paying, wage-paying job. They become a better drive in the society. You know, they have more of a voice when they have this. You know, when they have a better job, a stable job, there's, you know, less likelihood, sure, that people are going and, you know, going to jail. Mm-hmm. You know, are there communities where there is like a stronger equal opportunity model that's helped you know, tilt the scale a little bit? And if so, what is, you know, what are their solutions that they've implemented?
I can speak briefly to that. One example is what's called the Kalamazoo Promise. It's in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where a group of philanthropists and business leaders and community people put together a promise that if any kid who spent at least 3 years in the last 3 years in the Kalamazoo system, maybe 4 years, and they graduated with certain grades, they got a free ride to a public college. And what it's done for Kalamazoo is actually it's caused people to move to the city. And because people know, hey, my kids can get a free college tuition. Now, the thing is, it also has forced kids to be serious about their schooling, because there's a culture within the city, in families, in communities, in churches, whatever, saying, hey, are you part of that promise? Are you going to do this? And it's really turned the city around, both economically, but then also in individual stories. Has it been easy? No. I mean, I know talking to some teachers of one of the early results is a lot more kids stayed in school. They didn't drop out, which made larger classes and harder to teach. But that's what we want to see. That's what we have. So there are options. I mean, the other option is, you know, I know in Seattle and other places, they've raised the minimum wage up to like $15 an hour.
Right.
And that's certainly an option. I know this Thursday there's going to be a strike of low-wage workers around the nation demanding that minimum wage be raised. I think that would go a long way in helping our students.
You talked about this Sherwood, Whitefish Bay, Milwaukee. Is part of the answer here that we do need to come up with some kind of, I don't even know how you would do it, but this whole area needs to be better integrated. You look at other cities and you find much larger minority populations in suburban areas than you do here in Milwaukee, which is noticeable. So then you would have a natural integration of schools, et cetera. Why hasn't that happened here, James? And is that a piece of the puzzle here?
I don't know how far back you want to go. What I can say is when we were, you know, I was involved as an attorney in the Chapter 220 litigation. And at the time, we found that 97% of all African Americans in the metro area were lived in the city of Milwaukee.
97%.
Fewer than 3% lived in the suburbs collectively. And at that time, and this was in...
In the late 80s.
At the time, I think at that time, Brown Deer and Glendale had the highest numbers, followed by Shorewood. And that was just like Brown Deer was maybe 5% African American, Glendale, and then Shorewood was, you know. And then at that time, there were many, many suburbs that were, I'll use the term, lily white. I mean, as the, you know, the, that's what experts found in their reports. There were, you know, or, you know, it was 0.0, you know, whatever of a percent. And at that time, it made Milwaukee the most segregated in terms of African Americans being confined to the city. Now, there were, we did a lot of research because that case involved housing and education evidence, and we found that, as in many other places in the country, there were laws and policies implemented in all of those suburbs that, you know, resulted in keeping blacks out. You know, like the recent situation in New Berlin, you know, with the, you know, the a couple years ago. But I mean, there were attitudes that were reflected in the policies that, you know, kept these communities that way. Now, let's fast forward 20 years or so. I think, unfortunately, many of the attitudes, you know, remain, coupled with, as your prior, the prior caller said, the economic conditions now that in terms of housing and costs and so forth. But just, I go back to what I said earlier. Attitudes. There are so many people, quite frankly, if you talk to a lot of people, suburban and so forth, and I don't mean to paint with a broad brush and say everybody, but just who want nothing to do with the city and want, you know, they want to keep suburbs separated, want to not have transportation to, connecting people. And these attitudes, you know, I come back to the point, I start with saying attitudes because the segregation and separation and so forth, it's across the board. It's in it. It's reflected in the unemployment, the fact that people aren't, you know, they don't, African Americans and other minorities aren't given jobs. It's reflected then in the housing segregation. Mm-hmm. Even it's reflected then in the educational. It's reflected in incarceration. Now they are all related, but we don't have leaders, and by this I mean political leaders, as in our elected officials and our business leaders. We don't have people coming out saying, doggone it, this is unacceptable. In our community, this is just not acceptable. We're going to move the needle. Do you hear people saying that?
Let's go back to phone calls. We have tons of people calling in. Let's go to Ron next in Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. Yes. Drugs, incarceration, nonviolent crimes, legalization, and amnesty for all those who have been, I think, morally incarcerated for what's basically a sub-economy in impoverished neighborhoods and other places. What do you think that effect would be? And another question is, is the society naturally moving toward homogenization as there are more people advancing in their social circles as well as in their marriage? And these are two questions, but I see these as major helps in
Right. Thanks, Ron. Bob, go ahead.
I'll take the first. Right. You'll take the second. First one, I'm so glad the caller mentioned that, because quite frankly, drugs, we know the discussion about legalization and the what's occurring in the country. Now, I just want to say, in terms of the discussion of actually the new Jim Crow, you know, there's a book, Michelle Alexander has a book, The New Jim Crow, which her book, along with many other studies, point out that the so-called drug war is a main factor in incarcerating young black males for minor marijuana infractions. I'd say that, coupled with driver's license and other things that get people initial infractions with the law that then end up in a lifetime of incarceration and disenfranchisement. Now, Milwaukee leads the there's a study on that shows that while blacks and whites use marijuana at about the same rate, blacks are arrested, sentenced, and incarcerated at many times greater than white. And Milwaukee has the biggest gap in the nation in that. So, yes, that's a direct feeder to all of this. That's so the criminal justice system is another, you know, factor that figures into all of this.
Whole discussion.
I agree. I mean, certainly I see it in teaching 10 and 11-year-olds when their father's no longer in their home because of these minor infractions has a huge impact. As to the other point, I would say in terms of the homogenization of the United States, what is true is by a majority of the public school students in the U.S. today are students of color, and by the middle of the century, a majority of the U.S. population will be people of color. And there are some intermingling, but let's not underestimate the problems when children grow up in a completely segregated environment, which is true in many, many places of this country. We would be a much stronger democracy if kids from the very beginning were integrated together.
More phone calls in a moment. Schools and Communities United, releasing a report later this week. We're getting a preview of it now. Fulfill the promise the schools and communities our children deserve. This Saturday, May 17, is the 60th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. And we're talking this hour with Bob Peterson, president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association, longtime MPS teacher, James Hall, president of the Milwaukee chapter of the NAACP, about not only that event, Donna Brazile is the keynote speaker, but at how we dismantle current segregation, which is rampant in this area, Milwaukee area. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. More calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is a good email from Susan. There have been many community efforts to address these problems with minimal results. What is different about your efforts that will more likely get results? How do we get the people with the power and control over funds on board? And how do we get from the discussion and planning stage to implementation?
Well, part of it is that's why we're building a coalition. Schools and Communities United is a coalition of right now of 19 organizations. I think once people see our report, fulfill the promise of the schools and communities our children deserve, we're going to get a lot more members on board. It has to be a community-wide effort, and it is not going to happen overnight, but it has to start somewhere. It's true. We're not into just another study. We're into creating a changing the narrative in the city and coming up with very specific actionable plans and supporting and understanding that these are issues that are interconnected. Too often, I think, commissions are looked at, here's a school issue, here's an employment issue, here's this issue. We're saying we have to look at this together. So our coalition will support things like raising the minimum wage, expanding voter rights, and then lowering class size and a variety of different issues, not just education, not just community. I think that's one of the biggest differences this coalition has among the others.
Let's go to phones again, and Ann in Hortonville. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Hi, Ann.
I'm not going to talk about the Milwaukee schools. I have experience with Knoxville students. We moved down there from the Fox Valley about 25 years ago and lived there for 8 years. When I first came down there, there was on the news a black lady who was trying to get equal education for the inner city schools. The only thing, after a long time, she got was busing, which didn't last. And it did not solve the problem. My children went to one of the best schools in Knoxville, which had AP classes and advanced math and all that. Down in the inner city, they didn't have any advanced math classes mm-hmm. because it was felt that they were not intelligent enough.
So this, she's talking about inherently unequal education. Do you see any remnants of that? She's talking about Knoxville. Do you see any of that in Milwaukee right now, that there are, you don't have the same kind of opportunities in schools here?
If you compare an exurban or suburban school with an urban school, you can see big differences. If anybody goes to cross-country track meet from a, you know, you go from a school in Milwaukee out to a school in Waukesha, it's like worlds of difference just in terms of athletic facilities, mm-hmm. in terms of science labs, mm-hmm. computer technology, and so on and so forth. It's not to say Milwaukee doesn't have some fine facilities. The facility is actually fairly decent. But in terms of the opportunities, there's no comparison. And I think that's what the speaker talks about.
Yeah, thank you. Let's go to Jake in Milwaukee. Hi, Jake.
Hi. Yeah, I mean, things weren't great under Doyle, but I have to say right now with the state government that we have and their willingness to go into local matters from Talgo to our voting rights in the city, that, you know, we can do a lot of things here, but if we want to change anything, need a state control to stop the basically the ransacking of the city and the willingness to keep the city down because it does not vote Republican.
James.
I think the caller is exactly right. And I think, again, as we've said, one of the reasons we formed this coalition is to try to connect the dots and bring together a large group of people, some of the other organizations in the coalition, just so you'll know. All of us, or any of us operating in a silo, you know, can't do this. But let me just say, the significance of May 17th and Brown versus Board is because it seems that if there's going to be any occasion where we may be able to get these issues to resonate with people, then the commemoration of Brown is a clear opportunity to discuss them. And so that's why we view this as so important. And we have not only MTEA and NAACP, but 9 to 5, the ACLU, LGBT Community Center, the Institute for Wisconsin's Future, MICA, Voces de la Frontera, yeah. and others. So the point is, as your caller says, we have to have a broad base, and we realize it's not a sprint. This is going to be a marathon in terms of changing the politics and everything.
Nonetheless, what he said about there's obviously tension between the state of Wisconsin and the city of Milwaukee. If you live here, you know the tension. Nonetheless, this issue has been around. We've been an embarrassment on every front on this issue through Democratic governors, yep. through Republican governors, through Democratic mayors, because we've had nothing but except when we had socialists. I mean, there's something much deeper about this. It's more than political. It's more than Republicans in the State House. It's worthy of serious examination of how we could allow this embarrassment to keep going on and on and on and on.
Right. I mean, I think a lot comes down to the nation's history of what we people call white supremacy and racism. I know those are harsh words to use, but they're accurate. And let's have a conversation of that. It's white people don't have a lot of experience talking about race. That's one issue. But then there's also the yawning gap in economically, mm-hmm. and that's just spiraling out of control. And when you add race and economics together, you get a real difficult situation. And that's the situation we find ourselves in right here in Milwaukee today.
All right. It's Saturday is the 16th anniversary. Give us once again, we only have about 30 seconds or so left, 35 to stretch it.
We have a unity parade starting at 10 a.m. It's a 1 mile walk from the Martin Luther King Park, 14th and Valete, down to the Milwaukee High School of the Arts. Then we have a Fulfill the Promise program, which includes a keynote speaker, Donna Brazil, poetry, music at the Milwaukee High School of the Arts, and finally a working lunch and organizing session if anybody wants to stay from 12:30 to 2. The parade starts at 10. The program starts at 11. It's free and open to the public. People get a copy of a report at that, and we encourage everybody to come. You can go to Facebook, Schools and Communities United, or our website, schoolsandcommunitiesunited.org. Hope to see you there.
Schools and Communities United. .org. Great.
Yes.
Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to James Hall. James is president of the Milwaukee chapter of the NAACP. Bob Peterson, president of the Milwaukee Teachers Association, Education Association, teacher for many years, and the keynote speaker again, Donna Brazil, at the event on May 17. Thank you to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks for all of your calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of you. It's good to see there's a lot of response to the issue. That's encouraging. And thanks to KP for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up. We'll be with you again tomorrow. We're going to be talking about the state of the Gulf Coast, which is an issue that, you know, we talk about it on anniversaries, but what is the environmental health of the Gulf Coast at this point in time, and we invite you to stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening, everybody. Great conversations ahead.